This is your host, Jim Fetzer. The show is Non-Random Thoughts. I have a very special guest with us today. She is a member of the steering committee of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, an organization I founded in mid-December with Stephen Jones, professor of physics from Brigham Young University, a collection of scholars and experts and students who want to get to the truth about what happened to this nation on 9/11. We share the conviction that the government has been deceiving and misleading us, and that it has been using acts of violence in order to instill fear into the American people to manipulate us for its own political purposes. The person I have here today with us is an expert in many fields of engineering. She is perhaps the most accomplished woman I have ever known in terms of her intellectual and educational background. She is also the co-editor of the new Journal of 9/11 Studies, which she is editing with Steve Jones. It's my great pleasure to welcome to the show Judy Wood.
Hello.
Judy, I'm just so tremendously happy to have you on the show today. I think very few even members of ST-911 realize that you have a background and degrees in multiple types of engineering, including civil engineering, engineering mechanics, material engineering science, and mechanical engineering. I think you are living proof of the quality of expertise that we have in the society. Could you tell us something about how you became interested in engineering? Women engineers are not exactly dime a dozen.
Well, I was into bike racing when I was in high school, and I went to a friend's house, and they had a friend who was making things in his shop. And I was impressed how he was measuring things. He was looking at how much less resistance he had on the axle that he was going to replace in one of the bicycles. And he held his hand on the outside of the casing while the lathe was spinning around and said, "See how it doesn't heat up." And I thought that was pretty cool that he could actually measure something and measure a property. And I asked him, what did he study in school? And he said civil engineering. So I decided that's what I wanted to do.
That's terrific. You obviously had a very precise turn of mind. I mean, many of us could watch someone repair a bicycle, and it would never cross our minds to think of asking questions like that or what was actually going on from a theoretical point of view.
I didn't realize he was really doing experimental mechanics.
Tell us a little bit about these various fields. How did you acquire your background? Where did you go to school, and what degrees did you earn along the way?
I went to Virginia Tech. All three degrees were from the same building, so different departments. After completing my degree in civil engineering, I realized that I really wanted to be in engineering mechanics. And so I went into the Department of Engineering Science and Mechanics at Virginia Tech and studied composite materials experimentally, looking at thermal expansion behaviors of the different plies of a composite. And I ended up working at NASA for part of my degree as well, doing some experiments with thermal expansion that went into the development of the cargo bay doors of the shuttle.
Yeah, I'm rather fascinated to learn that you had anything to do with shuttle research. Could you tell us a little more about this? This is the Columbia, am I right?
Well, that was just the design in general. Where Columbia came to be, I always wanted to be an astronaut. That's where my heart was. And when the day that Columbia came apart upon reentry, I was pretty upset, especially because I think of thermal expansion properties. And when they talked about this foam hitting the shuttle wing on the way up, I concluded that it probably was indeed a failure due to thermal expansion. I made some quick calculations and realized it was so easy for that to be the method of destruction.
And I shared this. Yeah, go ahead.
And I shared this with my students the next class period, which was on a Tuesday, right after the shuttle came apart on a Saturday. And we argued about it, and I said, "Wait a minute, you guys know enough to be able to calculate this yourself. I could even put this on the first test." And I did that Thursday. And most of them got it correct. I was really proud of them.
Well, let me ask you more questions about this, because I was fascinated by the way in which the NASA started off with a very rigorous fault tree analysis where they were going to consider every possible alternative, and then the next thing I knew, they had dramatically reduced the range of alternative explanations and were focusing on the foam case, which troubled me tremendously because the principal evidence that they were offering, that the foam, impact of the foam on the wing of the shuttle, had led to the collapse of the plane on reentry and its disintegration, was supported by taking a chunk of foam that weighed something over a pound and firing it at 500 miles an hour into the wing and then displaying the damage that was done. Now, that was a stationary experiment. And an observation I made in a column I wrote about this was that in order for that experiment to have had any relevance whatsoever, there would have had to have been a 500-mile-an-hour relative increase in velocity between the chunk of foam when it broke off from the shuttle and actually impacted the wing. The distance there cannot have been more than 100 yards, maybe 100 feet.
Correct.
And it seemed to me inconceivable that that shuttle, as it's taking off, when the foam broke off, that between the time the foam broke off and the time it impacted with a shuttle, that it could have acquired a 500-mile-per-hour increase in velocity in order to hit the foam in such a way that such an experiment would make any sense at all.
Well, keep in mind that when the shuttle is taking off, it's rapidly accelerating up to 17,000 miles per hour.
Yes.
And also, the foam is not very aerodynamic, and it's going to have a lot of wind drag.
Yes.
So as the shuttle is accelerating, the foam is decelerating.
Yes. Well, I mean, assume, yes, I agree with that. I mean, the foam and the shuttle are traveling at the same speed, whatever it is, X, okay?
Right.
And then the foam comes loose, right? And
right.
Now the shuttle, it stays semi-stationary. You're talking about wind resistance. It's certainly not acquiring velocity in relation to the shuttle. Now it's losing velocity in relation to the shuttle. But
right.
That means the shuttle, between the time the foam breaks off and the shuttle wing actually hits it, has to have acquired 500 miles per hour increase in velocity in that brief interval of time. Now, is that a reasonable assumption?
Well, the shuttle is increasing speed and the foam is decreasing speed.
Yeah.
Here's a way of looking at it. A pickup truck driving down the highway has trash in the back and something blows out.
Sure.
And by the time it hits the pavement or hits your car, it's not going the same speed as it was when it left the back of that pickup truck.
Right, or it would never hit you at all. It would keep going the same speed as the pickup truck.
Right, that's a good point, too.
So,
it picks up a lot of drag from the wind.
So are you saying that my suspicions that this was a phony test that had no relevance to what actually happened?
Oh, it had a whole lot of relevance. It's the relative speed difference.
Yes, which is what I'm pointing to. You believe then it actually was the broken, the loose piece of foam that impacted with the wing that led to the thermal?
I knew that from the start.
Good.
And I even had the right location picked out, which they didn't have picked out for 2 more months.
Location on the wing where the impact would have had to occur for this damage to be done?
Correct. What was the key to me is that when the foam comes down, it makes a right angle turn when it splats out to the side. And for something to change direction that quickly, it has to have had a big impact.
And you figured out where it had to have impacted.
Well, I just saw from the videos they were showing on the TV.
Uh-huh.
And I had the right one.
Well, given that you have told us, that's great, Judy. That's very helpful because I've been presuming that 500-mile relative increase in speed would have been virtually impossible in the brief time interval. I'm glad to know you think that that's actually not the case.
I watched them like a hawk, the committee that was investigating this.
Good.
I watched every little bit of it, and the comparison with the 9/11 investigation is night and day.
Well, you see, I really like that because it seems to me we have no way to evaluate reports coming from our government unless we conduct our own investigation. If you don't already know at least a general relationship between evidence in a given case and what the government is telling us, you have no way to judge whether what the government is telling us is true. I found this, for example, to be the case with the Warren Commission report in relation to the death of John F. Kennedy and the NTSB report in relation to the crash that killed Senator Paul Wellstone, and, of course, in relation to the 9/11 Commission report with regard to the events of that fateful day. What was it, Judy, that drew you? Well, one more step. You did then complete a Ph.D. in mechanical engineering. Was that the culmination of your education?
I completed my Ph.D. in the Department of Engineering Science and Mechanics.
Yes.
Which is theoretical and practical applications of physics, basically.
That's fantastic. I mean, your background seems so perfectly suited to the study of, for example, the physics of the collapse of the Twin Towers, not to mention Building 7, which is so embarrassing to the government that the 9/11 Commission report ignored it, and NIST hasn't even pretended to offer an explanation for what happened there. What drew you into 9/11 research?
Well, better yet, my dissertation is in looking at thermal stresses in biomaterial joints.
Just the kind of phenomena involved in the alleged collapse of the Twin Towers.
Right.
Stand by, everybody. We'll be right back with my special guest, Judy Wood. This is your host, Jim Fetzer, welcoming you back to Non-Random Thoughts with my special guest, Judy Wood. Judy, your credentials are so imposing and so appropriate. I just wonder if, for any of those who may have joined us late, you could sketch how they set you up for the study of the collapse of the Twin Towers.
Well, my background is primarily in experimental mechanics. And with that, in my own words, in layman's terms, it's the finding the simplest way to get the information you're looking for from the data you have. And with 9/11, what bothered me on the very first day was the way the towers came down. So I looked at, is that possible?
Please do elaborate, because a lot of our listeners need the verbal image. What you're talking about, of course, is first you have the impact of these aircraft, which is causing minimal damage to the integrity of the structure. In fact, Frank DeMartini, who is the World Construction Project manager, said the intricate lattice work and the 47-core columns created such sophisticated load redistribution capabilities that the buildings could withstand multiple impacts of aircraft, which were whose effect would be analogous to sticking a pencil through mosquito netting. And then, of course, we had these fires, which are relatively modest. Most of the fire, the jet fuel, having burned off in these gigantic fireballs upon impact. And then these modest fires producing billowing black clouds, which are indicative of oxygen-deprived or starved fires, which means they're burning far below their optimal temperature. In fact, Underwriters Laboratory estimated they may have averaged as low as 500 degrees Fahrenheit, and yet the temperature at which Underwriters Laboratory had certified the steel before it would even weaken was 2,000 degrees for 6 hours. And, of course, the first building fell after, with the second tower hit second but falling first, fell after less than an hour. And the North Tower hit first but falling second an hour and a half. And, of course, the way they came down, there was these enormous something from the top. These buildings are collapsing from the top and being enveloped by this massive cloud of dust, and beams are being blown outward and upward. Was it phenomena like that, Judy, that disturbed you the most?
Yeah, on that day when I was watching it on the TV set, I thought this was a sci-fi movie. It just didn't look right. The building was unraveling. It just didn't make sense. It really unraveled from the top down.
Yes, and just to explain what Judy means by sci-fi, many science fiction movies are built on, you know, constructed around scenarios such as the possibility of space travel faster than the speed of light, and, you know, disintegration of bodies through space transport and then being reintegrated, phenomena that actually violate laws of nature. In other words, the only way they could happen would be for things to occur that cannot occur given the laws of physics, chemistry, biology, and so forth. Just to offer a simple example, none of us expect water to be frozen if the temperature is above 32, and none of us expect water to be liquid if it's below 32, so that we can predict and explain when we encounter water in various states why it's in that state in relation to the temperature. So what you're suggesting, Judy, is as you, as an expert in these multiple relevant fields. We're looking at a scenario that simply didn't make sense from the point of view of the laws of physics and engineering.
Correct. And part of my research work has been to look at engineering in nature. How does nature design structures? And perhaps we can copy those designs and use them in engineering designs. And one thing that struck me about the World Trade Centers is that they're very much like trees. Core, outer core, inner core. A tube within a tube design, and that's what allows a tree to wave in the breeze.
Marvelous.
But also I started thinking about how do trees come down. They don't start turning into sawdust, you know, from the top down. with sawdust flying out.
That's a perfect parallel, because what we actually have in the Twin Towers is they're blowing up from the top. Each floor is blowing up. So the sawdust, turning a tree into sawdust from the top, is perfect, Judy. Absolutely a perfect analogy.
Recently, I gave a talk at an engineering conference where I showed some diagrams of the towers being built and showed if this were a tree, and the Keebler elves cut out this big chunk out of the side here to put their little house or their where their dwelling is, would that affect the towers? And everyone in the room could see that, no, that the way the structure is designed, it can't bring it down.
And the little house would be analogous to the plane impact.
Right. You could have several planes. The planes hitting the towers were like a bullet being shot into a tree.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, I'm fascinated by the biological parallel in terms of structures in relation to actual engineering projects. So that's certainly something we want to explore here. I want to ask you, too, Judy, about the models that you have developed, like the one you're just describing. I mean, you must have just looked at what was going on and unfolding before your very eyes and in a state of disbelief that was rooted in scientific knowledge.
Correct. And to test what I was thinking, am I insane or is everybody else insane?
Yeah. Are you insane or is everybody else insane?
And I kept trying to test that sanity over and over again, and I came up with this model mentally, and then it wasn't working, so I started looking up in the...
Okay, we're going to be right back with okay. Judy Wood and her models of the collapse of 9/11. Stand by. This is your host, Jim Fetzer. The show is Non-Random Thoughts with my special guest, Judy Wood, who is a true expert on issues related to the collapse of the Twin Towers with degrees in civil engineering, engineering mechanics, material engineering science, and mechanical engineering. Listen, my friends, anyone who tells you that we don't have experts who are looking at this case and whose conclusions are authoritative don't know about Judy Wood. She's right here with us today. You can ask her questions during our second hour. I'm going to open the line to calls, 800-313-9443. 800-313-9443. During the second hour, you may call in and talk with a leading expert on the mechanics and engineering of the collapse of the Twin Towers. This is a unique opportunity. Meanwhile, I want to emphasize that this woman not only has a remarkable background, training, and expertise, but her capacity to develop models that are so simple and so elegant that they make what actually happened on 9/11 unmistakably clear, even to those of us who may be less scientifically or technically oriented, is incredibly important and impressive. I mean, reflect on what she said just before the break. Here's a scientist who's comparing phenomena in nature with man-made phenomena. She's not only talking about, you know, having a structure of a building designed analogous to the structure of a tree that gives it a certain degree of elasticity and resisting forces of wind, for example, but also how the way in which the buildings came down was analogous to taking a tree and having it turn into sawdust from the top down. Now, I dare say you and I have never seen such a phenomenon in nature, and for it to occur in this case required some source of energy, some massive explosive force that the government has tried to conceal from us. But as she will explain, there's no alternative account that makes any sense of what we're actually watching. As she was viewing these events unfold before her very eyes, she thought she was witnessing a science fiction movie. And the science fiction part was, as in the case of, you know, Star Trek productions or Star Wars, where you're traveling faster than the speed of light or being transported, a body is being transported through space from one location to another virtually instantly in time. Those things are not phenomena that can actually occur. Those violate laws of nature. They're physically impossible. They're logically possible. We can describe them without contradiction. But their occurrence actually violates basic laws of nature, including laws of physics. And in the case of 9/11, the collapse of the building, according to the government's account, in order to be true, would have to violate basic laws of physics and engineering. Welcome back, Judy Wood. It's such a pleasure to have you here. Would you tell us more about the models you've developed in your analysis of the collapse of the Twin Towers?
Well, thank you. I, again, wanted to look at it, a simplified model, just to test to see if what we were seeing, could it all be true? And I was thinking, if we're going to gut out 9 out of every 10 floors all the way down, pretend that we have a whole lot of damage, just to overcompensate for the damage, so we really only have one floor every 10 floors. And let's say on each of those 10 floors, somebody holds when the one floor falls onto the other, it becomes pulverized. And as we see from the pictures, is all this material flying out. We have this uniform dust covering the streets. So for it to pulverize like that, it takes a lot of energy. There isn't enough energy in the system from potential energy to pulverize it, but we'll pretend there is because, heck, we saw it come down, right? Let's look at the timing.
Let me just translate this for some of our listeners. We've got these buildings are being enveloped in gigantic clouds of dust. That dust has been created by the pulverization of the concrete flooring, by the disintegration of office furniture and equipment, including computers. It includes asbestos, with which that building was heavily laden, and, of course, residue from whatever it was that was this source of energy. The point Professor Woods is making is that even if you take into account the combined influence of the planes impacting the building, and the collapses were only occurring an hour or an hour and a half later, so the impact had no residual effects whatsoever, and basically had no effect to begin with anyway, given the design of the buildings. The fires were relatively modest at low temperature and were contributing very, very little to the buildings. They certainly were not at temperatures that could even weaken the steel, much less cause it to melt. And let me just mention, my friends, that if the building had been brought down the way the government claims by the weakening of the steel, since the sources of fire were asymmetrically distributed, it would have, if it were true what the government says, there would have been sagging, buckling. It would have taken a lot of time. You would have had one floor sort of gradually collapse, then another. But in fact, there's no scenario that makes that even plausible, because steel is an excellent thermal conductor, which means if you heat it up in one place, it's going to transfer that heat throughout the entire steel structure. So that in order to get one of the floors to even buckle or weaken, you have to have enough heat to heat up the steel structure on the entire floor. And what Professor Woods has observed is that there are many properties of the collapse of these towers that prove conclusively that the government's account of the collapse of Twin Towers is false. Proceed.
There isn't enough energy to pulverize the floors, and there isn't enough energy to buckle the columns. So there definitely isn't enough energy to do both. But we'll assume that there is. We're now going to look at the timing, because everybody can see the timing from wherever they stand. So pretend you have somebody standing on every 10th floor holding a billiard ball in their hands. Somebody drops the billiard ball from the roof at 110th floor, and as soon as it passes the 100th floor, the guy holding the billiard ball there drops that one. And then the one on the 90th floor, as soon as he sees that guy's ball pass by, he drops his. That would be analogous to one floor pulverizing on the next, and then the next floor, for whatever reason, giving way and collapsing down. So So if you look at every 10th floor pancaking down and assume absolutely no resistance in between the floors, if for some mysterious reason all the floors suddenly turn to dust as the collapse wave is going down, that's 31 seconds. That isn't even accounting for the pulverization energy or buckling of the columns energy. That's just looking at the timing.
And, of course, the key feature here in relation to which 31 seconds is a significant number is that according to the government's own account, the South Tower hit second but falling first, collapsed to the ground, utter pile of destruction, nothing left but very fine dust and a small amount of steel debris in 10 seconds. You can find that on page 305 of the government's official account, the 9/11 Commission Report. 10 seconds.
Well, the guy who tosses this billiard ball off the roof, just falling in a vacuum, not even considering air resistance, that's going to be 9.22 seconds for it to hit the pavement down below.
So if I'd, say, taken a grand piano and dropped it off of the South Tower at exactly the same time that the South Tower started to collapse, the grand piano would hit the ground and burst into dust and debris approximately the same time that that tower was completely demolished, notwithstanding that that tower was built out of steel 110 stories high and was an extremely intricate and scientifically and engineeringly ingenious construction.
Actually, I'm going to disagree with you there.
Tell me.
I think the grand piano will take longer to hit the ground because it's sort of like a parachute. It'll hit terminal velocity and won't keep going down because it's not in a vacuum.
Oh, this is fascinating, Judy. This is fascinating. So you're telling me that the buildings actually came down even faster than the grand piano because
if
there'd be air resistance, it would reach its terminal velocity.
Yes.
And which is further, I would say, Judy, this is a conclusive proof that those buildings had to be blown up, you know, according to a very sophisticated schedule, so that they were blowing out floors well below the cloud as it controlled them. I mean, at least initial explosions had to be taking place, did they not?
Correct.
Well, the envelopment of the cloud, you know, it's so enormous. There is some footage, for example, 9/11 Revisited. You can look that before the cloud, this enormous cloud of dust envelops the floors, you can see a couple of floors, flashes of red from there being blasted to pieces. Had to be going on behind, concealed behind the cloak created by the cloud of dust.
Right. And I believe the smoke that was there, all the black smoke pouring out, was the smoke screen. It sort of hid what was really going on in there.
Yes. Tell us more.
Well, if we didn't have that smoke coming out initially, it would look pretty funny seeing these mushroom clouds, you know, being launched up from the roof of the building when it came down. Because there's a whole lot of material that was launched upward into the upper atmosphere.
Yes.
And traveled quite a distance, which, how does it get launched up in such so much force?
Yeah, we're talking about steel beams, for example, being blasted outward and even upward, hundreds of feet, even more. It required a tremendous source of energy. Is there any possible explanation for steel beams being blasted outward or upward on the government's hypothesis that the collapse was due to the combined influence of the planes and the fires which led to a pancake collapse? Any possible source of energy that could explain it?
Well, I have trouble seeing how temperature can cause a brittle failure of the beams. Those beams that you see in the pictures being launched out are straight sticks.
Yes.
They're not bent.
Yes.
So,
yes, good, good, good. So they're not showing any of the signs that they would have displayed if they actually had been softened or weakened by heat.
Right.
And, of course, we know from the UL that they had certified the steel up to 2,000 degrees for up to 6 hours before it would even significantly weaken. And we know these fires burn too low and too briefly to cause that to happen.
And here's
it looks as though they're selling us, quite a whopper here, Judy.
Hey, here's an experiment anybody can do at home. Get some old metal coat hangers, wad them up, and make them into a grill that you're going to use to support a pot of water over a fire. So you want to bring that water up to a boil. So you start the fire, and that coat hanger grill, what's it going to do as the fire heats up? Is it going to shatter into straight little sections? Is it going to only turn to dust and have the pot slam to the ground? Or is the pot going to kind of just like ease on down as the fire heats up?
Sort of sag. We're going to have a gentle sagging, and it's going to very gradually occur. It's not going to be abrupt. It's not going to be sudden. It's not going to be total. That's a nice experiment. The suggestion has been made to me that if the kind of physics the government has proposed to explain the buildings were true, then our listeners on the 4th of July ought to be very careful about using their barbecue grills because they're liable to
explode. Or turn to dust.
I want all of our listeners out there, I want to realize you got to be real careful on the 4th, okay? Just realize what the government has told you about the physics of the collapse, because it could happen to you. I would say that the heat of your fires and the kind of the steel of your grill and so forth are all the kind of ingredients the government claims are going to be sufficient for those things to start blasting apart, blowing pieces out, or completely collapsing. So I just say, be forewarned, your government is telling you these things are true. So if your experience contradicts what the government is telling you, you have a choice. You can believe your government, or you can believe your lying eyes. That's what they tell us. Judy.
Yes. Well, I tried to see how on earth we could get the building down in 10 seconds. Another 10 seconds.
Yeah.
With this model I have, somebody holding a billiard ball and releasing it.
Yeah.
What I found was that if we're to get everything on the ground in under 10 seconds, that would mean that the 100th floor has to start moving before the 110th floor gets there to trigger its motion.
Yeah.
To break the tree.
To keep the motion continuous. There can't be a delay. I sometimes use a model, Judy, where I just stand there and take a key ring and release it just to see how long it takes a key ring to hit the ground. And I say, well, look, let's just try to figure out how long it might take, say, one floor to pancake on another. So I release my key ring and I start counting, 1,001, 1,002. I get out the word 1,000. Never can even get to 1, which means it takes about a half a second for me just standing upright holding the key ring out to let it hit the ground. So I say, well, look, suppose we assumed hypothetically that it took a half a second on the average for these floors to collapse one upon another, overwhelm its carrying capacity, and continue to collapse. I say, how long would that take? Well, there are 110 of them. So if it's only a half a second apiece, that should take about 55 seconds. 45 seconds too long in relation to the South Tower, for example. 45 seconds too long. Now, you, it seemed to me, have created more sophisticated models than that that are making even more drastic assumptions in favor of the government, and yet you have proven that it still can't occur in the time limits that actually reflect what happened in New York on that day.
Oh, it's fascinating. Let's say the guy on the 100th floor is holding a red billiard ball, and the guy on the 110th floor is holding a blue one. So he's sitting there waiting on the 100th floor to release his ball when the blue one gets there, but then we can't get everything on the ground in under 10 seconds. The guy has to release that red billiard ball 2.4 seconds before the blue ball gets there.
Really?
And on the 90th floor, that guy has to release his ball 2.4 seconds before the one on the 100th floor gets there. So they have to start moving before the collapse wave reaches there.
Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. And you're telling me that those buildings actually were coming down faster than free fall when you take into effect air resistance and the fact that the grand piano would reach a terminal velocity.
Yeah, but I don't know how you work in the air resistance of the building itself, but I think it wasn't coming down is the issue. When it's pulverized and up in the air, it's a loss for quite a while. It was several days before it came out of the air.
You make a great point. I mean, there isn't any air resistance. This building is being blown up one floor at a time from the top down. So there isn't any, you don't even need to factor in air resistance. Air resistance doesn't figure in the actual collapse of the building. So it makes a difference
to
a piano in free fall. But it doesn't make a difference to a building that's being blown up floor by floor from the top down, or to a tree that is turning into sawdust from the top down. Just think about it, my listeners. Your government has been selling you, peddling you fake science, junk science, lies, big lies. Big lies to conceal the mass murder of 3,000 of your fellow citizens. You think about it. We'll be right back.
But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out?
This is your host, Jim Fetzer. The program is Non-Random Thoughts with my special guest, Judy Wood, who is an expert member of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, an organization that I founded with Steve Jones as my co-chair in mid-December, which consists now of some over 300 members divided into four different categories, at least 200 of which have research skills appropriate for conducting investigations on different aspects of this case, and over 85 have academic affiliations, none, in my judgment, more highly qualified to study the mechanics of the collapse of these buildings than our guest, Judy Wood, here today. Judy, just ask a question that someone who has been impressed by what the government has said. The government claims that the National Institute of Standards and Technology has done a thorough investigation and that it has fulfilled its responsibilities under the law to be objective, where objectivity in its sense includes presentation and substance. Presentation includes the clarity of the information in an accurate, complete, and unbiased manner. Substance involves a focus on ensuring accurate, reliable, unbiased data as the foundation for its analysis. I ask you, as an expert in these fields, has the NIST fulfilled its obligations under the law?
Sure hasn't convinced me. Matter of fact, to the contrary. At a recent conference where I was presenting my work, Frank Gale from NIST was presenting something that he had prepared, and I had some questions for him at the end that he didn't seem to be able to answer.
Tell us more. Tell us more. Now, you're saying Frank Gale actually is a representative, works for NIST, the government agency that your government would tell you has explained all this away, so that what Judy Wood and I and other members of the Scholars for 9/11 Truth are telling you is just a lot of hot air, a lot of, you know, smoke and mirrors. But the truth, the facts of the matter, point in the opposite direction. Tell us more.
At the end of his presentation, one person in the audience asked him about the delamination of the fireproofing, and on the screen, Frank Gale drew his laser pointer around each of the exterior columns and then around the entire building and said that the fireproofing came up all the way around.
Did he offer an explanation why, how that would be physically possible?
I about lost it there. And the person who asked the question just backed off. They were shocked at that answer.
What you're saying is that the steel columns on the basis of which this building was constructed were coated with asbestos, and he's claiming, which is necessary for his account to make even remote sense, that all of that coating just came off all at once simultaneously
right
throughout the entire building.
So I asked him, you're telling me that you have asymmetrical damage, asymmetrical fire, and let's assume your fireproofing comes off at the exact same moment around every single one of these 200 and some odd columns at the exact same moment, and the building collapses straight down.
We'll be right back with that thought. Hold that thought, Judy Wood. We'll be right back, and we'll be taking your call. This is Jim Fetzer. The show is Non-Random Thoughts with our special guest, Judy Wood. Before we go to our first callers who are standing by, I'd like to return to the scene of the conference, Judy, where you confronted Frank Gale of the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which the government claims has provided an expert, authoritative, thorough, complete, and conclusive report that explains away all the questions that have been raised by experts across the board, especially members of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. And, Judy, you are telling me that at the end of his presentation, you asked him how it could possibly be the case that asymmetrical causes, such as these modest fires scattered throughout the building, could bring about the sudden and complete loss of this asbestos coating on all the steel throughout the entire structure, which, of course, is not only absurd on its face, but would be a completely symmetrical and unpredictable, certainly not expected effect of this asymmetrical cause.
Correct. You have asymmetrical damage asymmetrical fires, and let's assume that you do have the exact same temperature around every one of the columns, the core columns and the perimeter columns, that happen to all lose their fireproofing at the exact same time, how do you have this perfectly symmetrical collapse? Frank Gehl's answer shocked me. He said, oh, you forgot, gravity is symmetrical.
Well, gravity may be symmetrical, but all of that fireproofing remained on all that steel for all those years since the buildings were constructed. They began construction 1966 to 1970. What's going on in the 40 years since? Gravity was affecting them. Gravity was there before. Gravity was there during. Gravity was there after. Gravity obviously can't be the relevant factor since it did not change. So what did he think he was doing there?
I do not know. It seemed as though he didn't have another answer. And folks around the room, you could hear gasps around the room. He didn't
gasps
understand.
Around the room that he would take such a desperate effort to pull a rabbit out of a hat to answer a simple elementary question that confronts his own account, representative of the NIST's official position.
Correct. Then he went into, well, it then turned into, as you saw, it turned into a global collapse. And
yes.
I asked him about that.
It. Yeah, what was it? What is it, Frank? What is it that turned into a global collapse?
The single floor collapsing turned into this global collapse. And I asked him where the analysis was that would show this global collapse was caused by the one floor.
Right. Saying it is a different thing than proving it. What's his evidence? What's his argument?
He said it was inevitable. And I then asked him again, where's your analysis, your scientific analysis?
Right. Where are the laws that bring about the inevitable? Of course, to be inevitable, these have to be deterministic laws. Same cause, same effect. In principle, they're testable. They're empirically testable. They're potentially explanatory when the conditions to which they apply are realized. He appears to be not only not identifying the laws, but also not identifying the conditions that would have to be present to bring about their operation.
Finally, we went back and forth several times, and I wanted to see an analysis or see some sort of scientific reason why it was inevitable. And finally he said, oh, I had nothing to do with that. I'm just a materials expert. The civil engineers did that.
Civil engineers did that. Did what? He's got his own colleagues there, and he doesn't know their own analysis of the phenomena that he's there presenting a paper on at a conference?
Correct.
What a staggering admission of incompetence or duplicity. There are only two alternatives here. Either the man is massively incompetent and doesn't deserve to hold the position he does, or he's being incredibly duplicitous, deceiving you, lying to you, to your very face. This is staggering. We have some callers, Judy. We have, let's take our first caller, Bill in Texas. Bill, are you there?
So much. I'm so honored to speak to both of you. First, I'd like to ask, I'm probably, you're preaching to the choir when it comes to me, and so I would like to engage in what I would call shop talk with you all. But I'm not sure. Maybe the audience for this is more people who aren't as deep into this as we all are.
Yes.
But if I could engage in shop talk, one of the things that I've been doing, and I've been obsessed as much as I think others have with this because it's just so frustrating to imagine how this could be happening to, how we could be lied to like we are. I've been trying to go back to the news reports of 9/11, what was published about the towers, what it said. I actually found where the pancake theory was first reported in a newspaper, and I don't have the name, but one of the things it led me to, and I'd like to ask Judy or either one of you about this, if you know, there's this huge multinational conglomerate that's huge into building and structural engineering and engineering consultant.
That's how.
Called ARUP.
Okay.
ARUP.
Go on.
Have you heard of them, Judy?
No, I haven't.
One of the representatives from ARUP was interviewed in England or from his office or over the phone, and he was one of the first people to put out the pancake theory. And I encourage everybody to Google ARUP and look at who they are. And the reason I think that's so important, and this is obvious to you and me and Judy, but I don't think it's obvious to a lot of other people who aren't so deep into this, the evidence leads you to see that there was a team. I don't know whether it was a team of 10 people or a team of 100 people, but there was a significant team that was pre-stationed, knew that this was going to happen, and the evidence leads you to conclude they had their disinfo campaign arranged to happen. Everything from interviews around Ground Zero, everything to newspaper interviews, and as you begin to look at this, you understand not just how Frank Gehl may be lying, but you understand that this plot was well done. I mean, even you wonder why MIT's Thomas Eagar was so ready to pitch into the nonsense. You wonder all these questions.
Phil, this is fascinating. I want to ask you to elaborate more, but let me draw a parallel. After the death of U.S. Senator Paul Wellstone in the final stages of a campaign against Norm Coleman, the hand-picked candidate for the White House, a memorial service was held. Because his death had occurred in the last 10 days of the campaign, it was perfectly predictable that the memorial service would have political aspects and overtones. And in fact, his former campaign manager made a rather impassioned speech about completing the campaign, you know, getting back on that bus for Paul Wellstone. Now, Republicans all over the country began immediately savaging the Democrats, trashing them for having had this memorial service and having turned it into a campaign rally. Now, I say this was precisely the kind of opportunistic seizing the moment, having a pre-positioned plan, a previously in-place plan. I was watching Peggy Noonan, for example, on a panel discussion on MSNBC, and she began hammering this theme, hammering this theme. I think the Republicans were so apprehensive that this memorial service was going to inspire Democrats across the country that they had to tarnish it some way. They knew there'd be some political aspect and that they could magnify it, exaggerate it, and use it as a tool. Now, that's a small example of having an anticipatory plan. There was no way in which Peggy Noonan actually had witnesses or knew what actually had happened in Minneapolis. She wasn't there. She didn't have access. She had no reports that I know of other than the report to have the green light to go ahead and do this. Now, what you're saying, I think, is absolutely correct. There are parallels with JFK. Immediately, there were announcements being made. Merriman Smith, who was way back in the motorcade, was immediately reporting three shots fired. Well, hey, the acoustics in Dealey Plaza are such that it's very difficult to sort out how many shots might have been fired. Most of the weapons were silenced. He was offering a premature version of a story that was widely announced then, so headlines around the country said three shots. Well, we've actually gone back and we've investigated the death of JFK, and frankly, 8, 9, or 10 shots were fired in Dealey Plaza during the assassination. So you've begun to see how effective it can be and what a difference it can make to start disseminating false stories that support a predetermined account of what happened in a significant case. And the one you're talking about, of course, is overwhelming, 9/11. Tell us more, then, how you could tell that this was a scheme that had been coordinated to disseminate false information about 9/11.
Well, actually, and Professor Wood may be able to explain this. I took some engineering in college, but I can't claim to be an expert. But what leads you to the conclusion that they were pre-positioning is because if you look at the scientific evidence, which you are looking at, it's impossible for the scientific educational community to buy into this unless there was a massive way of controlling this. And I think that's the thing that I don't want to take Professor Wood's time away from this, but that's the thing that once you realize what collusion and what has gone on, the next question is, how on earth did they get these people to cooperate in this?
These are really good questions, Judy.
We know once all that New Mexico Tech took in a total of around $85 million in grants for changing a story. But, no, I'm sorry. It just happened to be, it was coincidental, a week later, he recanted his story, and they got $85 million in grants.
Isn't that amazing? Go on.
And actually, I want to allow time for other callers. But
no, you're doing fine, Bill.
I'd like to make kind of a criticism or a question that hopefully, I mean, I am following this, and I guess my heart and soul is based on us being successful in communicating with the rest of the American people. So as I see you on your PR campaign, Professor, I want to give you a general question or a general thing. I see you're going to be with Laura Ingraham tomorrow.
Yes.
And I would just ask you, if you're calculating to be kind of in your face in terms of your approach.
Now that would be telling, wouldn't it, Bill?
And I just would...
Look, let me just say, I understand where you're coming from, and I appreciate your concerns, and just... you don't worry. Let's see what happens. Stand by. We'll be right back with Judy Wood and Bill in Texas.
Fly into the line of
the dark black night.
This is your host, Jim Fetzer. We're on Non-Random Thoughts with my special guest, Judy Wood, and we're completing a phone call with Bill in Texas. Bill, before we turn to another caller, would you have any other questions for Judy Wood?
I don't have a question for Judy. I honor your work. I appreciate your involvement. And Professor Fetzer, I just would suggest that maybe a soft shoe type approach might be a little bit better.
Bill, thank you so much for calling. Okay, it's been great having you on. Excellent questions and 100% appreciation of your call. Thank you so much. We have another caller, Kevin in Colorado. Kevin.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Judy. I just got a couple observations, and then I have one question.
Sure.
First of all, the reason for the speed of the collapse of the towers, wouldn't that be due to the fact that the explosions actually evacuate the air and therefore create an entire vacuum down the height of the building, which causes it to fall?
Which explosion? Do you mean from a controlled demolition, from pre-position explosives?
Yeah.
Yeah. That could contribute, that you could have those explosives going off and they suck all the oxygen out of the air, they consume it, because explosion is a form of oxidation and therefore that might be a contributing factor. Okay, what we'll ask an expert here in one moment. And what's your other, another question related to that?
An opposite to that is that if there weren't explosions and if you were to believe a pancake theory, the fact that you have these sealed pillows of air on every floor, wouldn't that even further slow down the collapse of the towers because there's this total enveloped air cushion on every floor?
That's very nice. Very nice, Kevin. I'm going to bring you back. I'm not going to cut you off. I'm going to bring you back for your comment. We're going to just turn these questions over to Judy first. Judy?
Okay. Yes, well, as for his first observation, if you're turning the building into dust, into just totally pulverizing it, the timing is only relevant as far as setting off the detonations. There's no collapse timing of material, because once the material's been pulverized, it's aloft and it's not touching the building.
Good. So there isn't a mass to press down for the vacuum to make a difference.
Correct. It's just the timing of the detonation of the charges.
Because the vacuum would only make a difference if you had something in free fall like that grand piano we were talking about.
Right.
And then, of course, there could be sufficient air resistance that would slow it down and come to a maximum speed. But in this case, there's nothing falling because it's all being turned into sawdust, as you put it, as it comes down. So the presence or absence of the vacuum wouldn't contribute to the speed of its disintegration.
Correct. And if you were going to bring down the towers by controlled demolition, if you were hired to do that job, you would want to do it the safest way possible to not damage adjacent buildings. The only way really to do it is to blow up the top portion, because you can't control, it's over a quarter of a mile tall. You can't control where that part's going to fall. But pulverizing it, you don't have a control problem.
Yeah, if you had terrorists who were actually trying to do a lot of damage, I mean, that's the idea, presumably. They'd want the building to topple over or crush other buildings. Lots of citizens, cars, automobiles create panic.
Yes.
Didn't happen that way, did it?
Nope.
Isn't that amazing?
Mm-hmm.
Kevin, I want you to offer whatever other comments you want to propose.
Okay. I mean, if one is to believe this pancake theory, that means that you disbelieve the fact that this dust all over Manhattan is actually mainly concrete. And then if you believe the pancake theory and all these floors pancake down upon each other down to the ground level, what would the height of that pile of concrete be?
That's great. In other words, where are the pancakes? Where's the stack? You know, we can go into Perkins and order pancakes. And if they brought us a pile of dust, we wouldn't be happy, right? Where are the pancakes? Remember the old commercial, where's the beef?
Yeah.
Right? Now we're asking, where are the pancakes, Judy?
I didn't see any.
How many should there have been? What should it look like if the pancake theory were true?
I would think if the pancake theory were true, I would think it would have behaved more like an avalanche, where one part keeps adjusting as another piece adjusts, something else moves, and something else moves, and you'd have this huge pile of rubble that would be adjusting.
And the huge pile of rubble might have been, what, 10, 20, 30 stories high?
Probably somewhere in there.
Somewhere in there, because you're putting together 110 floors.
Correct.
And each of them has mass, and each is a contributor to the pile of rubble. It's going to be pretty impressive. But in fact, you know, observers came, and they were stupefied, stunned. They looked at where these 110-story buildings had been, and all they could find was dust. They couldn't even find a part of a desk or a chair or a telephone or a computer. Just a mass of very fine dust. Utterly inexplicable on the government's official account. And yet that's what happened in New York on 9/11. Kevin, do you have more comments you'd like to toss in?
No, that's just it. Thanks for the great work you guys do.
Well, I want to thank you for calling. Excellent questions. Very useful in illuminating what's going on here.
Okay, thanks.
Judy, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back, and we'll talk about your models and your research and go further. Thanks so much for being here. Jim Fetzer, Non-Random Thoughts.
Living is easy with eyes closed. Misunderstanding all you see. It's getting hard to be someone, but it all works out. It doesn't matter much to me. Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real, nothing to get on about. Strawberry Fields forever.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on Non-Random Thoughts, welcoming you back to our special interview with Judy Wood, who is a prominent member of Scholars for 9/11 Truth and the co-editor of the new Journal of 9/11 Studies, which has been established by Judy and Steve Jones, professor of physics from Brigham Young University, who is my co-chair and who assisted me in founding the organization. Of experts, scholars, and other students who are committed to exposing falsehoods and revealing the truth about the events of 9/11 and letting the chips fall where they may. Judy, we do have a caller from Canada, but before we turn to him, I would like to ask you about your recent participation in the Society of Engineering Mechanics Conference and about what you had to say there, and we'll go from there.
Well, at the conference, I gave a presentation on my billiard ball models, and these were senior-level engineering professors in the area of experimental mechanics, engineering mechanics, and mechanical engineering. And surprisingly, they hadn't really ventured into questioning the story that we were given on 9/11. Dead set on believing the official story, it's always a treacherous maneuver to expose them to the truth. And I carefully went through my presentation and let them come to the conclusion on their own that there was just no doubt that the building could have come down as quickly as we were told, within an order of magnitude at that time.
No doubt that the government's account had to be false, just based on the very simple consideration you were advancing in relation to time.
Correct. I just was looking at time, because that's something we can all observe. And at the end, during the question and answers, one fellow wanted to time one of the videos I was showing, thinking that he can come up with something more than 10 seconds, but then another person spoke up and said, okay, so it's 10.1, 10.5 seconds or 12 seconds. That's a long way away from 100 seconds.
That's right. If it took a second per floor, for example, it would be 110. A half second per floor, 55. Judy, we have some callers. We have some callers stacked up. I'm going to start inviting them in. We're going to begin with Neil in Canada. Are you there, Neil?
Good day, sir.
Please.
Hello, G.
Hello.
I was just looking up some research on who started this pancake theory, this crazy theory. And USA Today, on September 12th, 2001, they have, I'll just read it here. It says, the momentum was too much to handle, says William Fasten, a partner at Leslie E. Robertson & Associates, the structural engineers for the towers. A given floor normally could support the weight of the three floors, but that assumes that the weight is imposed in a gradual manner. and there was nothing gradual about the process once each tower began to collapse. It took just moments for the growing weight and velocity of the wreckage to rip through the lower floors as though they were tissue. The buildings imploded just as they would if demolition experts had been hired to do the job.
Isn't that great? Isn't that wonderful? This
yes,
is the cover story right in your face. Wonderful.
Isn't that amazing?
That's wonderful, Neil. That's wonderful, wonderful, wonderful.
I'll email you off that link and get that up on the site.
That's great. I think we'll have to add it to
sp911.org.
Judy?
Yes, that's a great article.
I mean, it just shows the duplicity right there. And see, when they say that the effects would be as though, just the same as if it had been controlled demolition, that means this is the plausible deniability in relation to the evidence that proves it was controlled demolition.
Yeah, exactly.
Like what Dan Rather said on the evening of 9/11.
When he was reporting that it was coming down.
He said, well, gee, this looks just like controlled demolition.
crazy.
So who are you going to believe, the government or your lying eyes? Neil, thank you so much for the call.
Thanks for everything you're doing.
Thank you. Alan in Texas. Alan?
Yeah.
Alan in Texas. Alan?
Hi there. This is Ripper Hanser calling, actually. It's
okay.
Nice to talk to you both.
Our pleasure.
Done some articles and a bit of just sort of rebutting some of the attacks that have been coming towards you guys lately. But what I wanted to point out was whenever I bring up Judy's billiard ball model for people to consider, I get letters like this one. This one was posted at 911 Blogger, and it goes like this. It has been pointed out to me that your billiard ball model does not take the transfer of kinetic energy into account, and it goes on from there, as in, that is, as each ball hit the next, it would transfer some of its energy to the next ball. And the typical point they're trying to make is that there should be some acceleration, and it's not accounted for in your model. And I was wondering if you could address that.
Sure, Judy.
Well, it's been shown through papers of other people that there wasn't enough energy you can develop through kinetic energy to pulverize the floor. There was also not enough energy to collapse the columns.
Since there's not enough energy to do either of those, here these accounts require that there be enough energy to do both.
And
Judy's analysis is based on just giving them premises that are false, that can't be true, and studying the temporal relations to show that even in addition, if you assume there were enough energy of those two different kinds, it still can't be true, given the observed evidence. Is that right, Judy?
Correct.
All right, well, thanks for that. And another question I wanted to ask was, why is there just sort of this tacit silence coming from the structural engineering community? Is it because they, you know, don't want to conflict with the work that the AC or ASCE did for NIST? I was just wondering if you could speculate on that.
Well, this is a great question. I mean, you know, these people lack integrity or they are corrupt. I mean, it cannot be the case that they can look at the physics of these collapses, which are so simple and so elementary and where the evidence is so obvious, and not understand that the government has been lying to the American people. So what do they have, a greater loyalty to their contracts, to their jobs, to their businesses? Or do they have some transcendent obligation as American citizens to speak up on behalf of this nation and help to preserve our constitutional republic? I am disgusted with the structural engineers who know the truth about this and are keeping their mouths shut. There's a special place in hell reserved for them, and they are going to deserve it. I cannot thank you enough for asking the question.
Do you have any comments on that, Judy?
I totally agree with what Jim said.
Okay, well, I'll just close. I'll let you get on to another caller. The last thing I'd want to say is there must be a limited hangout theory that is going to come out, because if Professor Jones is correct and he can prove that thermite was used, I believe that there will be some sort of cover story. And if you want to speculate on that, that's fine, but I'll let you move on to the next caller. Thanks.
Ellen, that's great. Good questions. I really appreciate your call. Just to fill in for the sake of our audience, Steve Jones, who's done a tremendous amount of study about the physical, possible alternative physical explanation of the collapse, believes that a very powerful explosion known as thermite was used in a sulfur-enhanced version known as thermate, and that in order to bring about the pulverization of the concrete, the office furniture, and all that, it may very well have been in a nanotechnology-enhanced version called super thermate that this could account for the phenomena that were observed here and explain all the evidence we have available about the collapse, and that during the 2 weeks before or prior to 9/11, there were abnormal security lapses in the Twin Towers. Major sections of the buildings were closed down. The employees were sent home. The security apparatus was shut off. And teams, being described as engineers, were sent in and out of the buildings to have free access to all parts of the building, ostensibly to do recabling in the building, but it had never happened before. And Steve estimates that as few as 10 men, making 40 men making 10 trips apiece could have implanted enough thermite to bring about the explosions that we observed and all of those effects. Judy?
Well, one beautiful thing about ST-911, about our group, is that we have a number of different standalone just proofs of the government story. Any one of them takes it down. So it's not dependent on just one, and they all fortify each other.
That's right. So I think it's going to be very difficult to come up with a fallback once the true dimensions, the magnitude of the deception has been exposed. And here's something quite striking. NIST admitted they found sulfur residues on the steel, which they could not explain. And of course, however, that would be a predictable effect from the use of thermite, since it's a combination of sulfur with thermite. Plus, now, Steve Jones has acknowledged, has reported in the last couple of weeks that he has, in addition, discovered residues of thermite on some of the steel. The government made its best effort to get rid of all the evidence. Mayor Giuliani was out there ensuring it be loaded up and shipped off to China by a very efficient company by the name of Controlled Demolition Incorporated. But some samples have remained, and Steve has had access to them, and he's discovered what I would take to be conclusive evidence that these buildings were brought down by thermite. We're going to another caller, Alan in Kansas. Alan, are you there?
Hello.
Yes, Alan, please.
Okay, I got two parts.
Go.
Number one, I've been thinking about if, let's say we got a pancaking effect like they're trying to tell us, and the internal was absolutely of no resistance down to about floor 50, all the pressure of that pushing straight down from floor 50 down should have pushed the outer walls out like a banana peel. And they should have been laying out, spread out, like it should have ruptured that building.
That's fascinating. That's completely fascinating. Judy, what do you think about that?
I think because it wasn't the top half of the building falling as one unit, but it was floor by floor by floor.
But, I mean, he's saying, Judy, it's like the trash compactor model. He's saying if you got all these floors pancaking, that they should have brought enough pressure. I mean, that's essentially a hermetically sealed building. Shouldn't have been the case that there was enough air pressure building up that the walls should have expanded or blown out.
Should have blown out just as if you got a pressure vessel and you're pushing in on it like a bicycle pump,
mm-hmm.
and it gets too much pressure. Somewhere around 450, that should have just blown the walls straight out to the side.
That's a very good point, that they should have gone straight out to the sides, not up.
That's right. That's right. Just like a banana peel, it should have just ripped the walls out to the side just from the pressure of that mass pushing down inside.
This is a very interesting observation, Alan. Please tell us more.
Okay, second part is when trying to figure the fall, I don't remember enough calculus and haven't worked this to do it, but it's like if you're trying to figure the pressure on the gate at the bottom of a dam,
yes.
you know the deeper you go, the more pressure per square inch.
Yes.
You have to use calculus to consider the force on that gate.
Yes.
Now, if you go up to like 100 floors, the first floor, if you're talking about this being cut on the way down, first floor, the 100th floor only fell to floor 99. The next floor, 99, only fell to floor 98. All the way down to the bottom floor, floor 1, only fell to the ground floor.
So yes.
If you need some kind of calculus, way to figure the speed of this, because I think somewhere in that, each floor just falling one floor, you're going to find you lose a little bit of, I mean, you actually gain speed because you lose the distance of the fall.
Very interesting. Judy actually has developed a model that has elasticity and can account for virtually any scenario that one wants to pose. Judy?
Which model are you talking about? Like the 4x4?
Yeah, variations, because he's now talking about 1 4x1 4.
I'm saying if each floor, if it was cut on the way down, between the cuts, above the cut only fell the distance to the next cut.
Right.
You see, and then that cut only fell to the distance of the next cut. So I'm saying we're not talking about the speed of, say, 100 or 110 floors falling, 100 and 110 floors. We're only talking about the speed of falling
one floor.
Next cut accumulated
one floor
all the way down.
One floor at a time.
And with my model looking at one floor falling to the next floor to the next floor, I calculate a minimum of 97 seconds.
Terrific. See how close that is to 1 second per floor? Alan, you're making an excellent point. I'm real tickled with your call.
Well, I'm just thinking on this and listening to you, and I'm saying, you know, it's not as obvious as it might be out front, you know, with somebody just counting change.
Yeah.
It's not just 100 floors falling 100 floors.
Yes. But this is a key thing, Alan. You're thinking about it. They don't want the American people to think about it. Remember, the government said, don't think about outrageous conspiracy theories, concealing at one and the same time that the government's own account of these 19 Islamic fundamentalists hijacking these four planes using box cutters under control of a man in a cave off in Afghanistan was itself a conspiracy theory. We have indeed been demonstrating how outrageous it is. We aren't the conspiracy theorists. We're critics of the government's own outrageous conspiracy theory, and we've only been forced to these conclusions of necessity given the logic and the evidence of the situation we confront. Alan, excellent, excellent call. Thank you so much. Jeff in Florida. Jeff, are you there?
Yes. Do you hear me?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, I did a calculation. I'm a physics professor, and I just wanted to ask Judy to check my calculation briefly.
Sure.
I calculated how much potential energy there would be under the government's pancake theory versus how much energy it would take to pulverize the concrete into fine dust into 60 micrometer fragments. And I come up with about 500 times difference in energy too much. In other words, the potential energy would be too small by a factor of 500. Does that sound reasonable, Judy?
That sounds in the right ballpark.
Okay.
I've heard numbers of 100.
Yeah.
So 500 depends on what safety factors you're thinking of, and so forth, but you're right in the right ballpark.
A fracture energy of 6,700 joules per kilogram and shattering it into 60 micrometer fragments for the dust. And with that figure, and then taking about, I don't know, 6 meters per floor, how much potential energy, that's what I came out with. So,
just to translate for our listeners out there, what the professor of physics has calculated is that the difference between the actual energy available from, say, for example, the crash of the planes and the modest fires, if there had been a pancake effect, is 500 times too low, too little, too lacking in enough energy to convert all that concrete, that desk furniture, that asbestos and everything else into fine dust. He's calculating that the government's account is a whopper, a giant lie by a factor of 500. You think about that.
I want
to compliment you for your call.
I was just curious, and that calculation took me all of about 15 minutes.
And this is further confirmation of structural engineers, you see. They are cowards. They know enough. The physics is elementary. It took Jeff 15 minutes to figure out that the government was lying by a factor of 500. Where are the structural engineers who have some integrity and who care about their country and are committed to keeping this a free nation? Where are you? Where are you? Where are you? We'll be right back with Judy Wood. This is Jim Fetzer. The program is Non-Random Thoughts with my special guest, Judy Wood. I just want to translate that Beatles song for the benefit of those who don't know, but in England, paperback is a slang term for a dirty book. And I just want to say that we have a perfect example of a paperback that's been given to us by the federal government. It's called the 9/11 Commission Report. It's pornography. It's not true. It's talking about the death of 3,000 American civilians, and it's betraying their lives by shoveling lies, deception, deceit on the American people. We have the expertise, we have the knowledge, we have admirable people like Jeff in Florida and Judy in South Carolina and Steve in Utah who are doing their best to tell you that the government is shoveling manure on the American people, playing us for suckers, playing us for saps. Bogey wouldn't have taken it. We aren't going to take it. Don't let yourself be played for a sucker. The American government is lying and deceiving the American people, using acts of violence and threats of acts of violence to instill fear into us so it can manipulate us. Hitler knew this. Hermann Göring knew this. He said it's very easy to manipulate the people. Tell them they're subject to an external attack, and they will gladly surrender their liberty. Benjamin Franklin observed, if we're willing to sacrifice liberty for security, then we deserve neither liberty nor security. My friends, this is a monstrous lie, a monstrous lie. There are many reasons why Dick Cheney and George Bush resisted having any investigation at all. If this man truly were committed to our security, there should be nothing more important than find out what happened on 9/11, who was responsible, and why it happened. His attitude has been precisely, exactly the opposite. Stonewalling, pushing it off, resisting until the political pressure from the families of 9/11 victims made it politically impossible to resist any longer. And then he tried to put in charge who? Henry Kissinger, a guy who's just terrific to run a commission if you want to bury the evidence, if you don't want anyone to know the truth. And then when Kissinger was rejected, who did he put in his place? Philip Zelikow. Philip Zelikow, my friends, is not an historian. Philip Zelikow, my friends, is not a scientist. Philip Zelikow is an expert in the creation and manipulation of myths. You go right now to Wikipedia, you look at Philip Zelikow, and you see what you find about this man. This man has created a monstrous myth. He has created a myth based upon phony cell phone calls, imaginary hijackers whose names aren't on any passenger manifest, never subject to any autopsy. Phony fabricated tape recordings that have conversations of passengers talking about they're going to use a drink cart to break down the cabin door from the cockpit voice recorder. Just think of this, my friends. Cockpit voice recorders do not record conversations in passenger compartments. You think about it. Your government is only the biggest liar in the world. That's all. That's your government. That's your president, George W. Bush. Thank you for joining us.